My name is Monica Cruz, and I serve as faculty member in the graduate program in public administration. Dr. Henry Flores gave me the honor of allowed me to welcome everyone this evening. So we want to welcome you, each of you, to this evening's community conversation, sponsored by the Institute of Public Administration, Politics, and Public Policy, in coordination with Women's History Month. Since 2011, the Institute has sponsored a series of conversations and invited leaders in our community to discuss issues important to the viability of San Antonio. During the month of March, hundreds of presentations and celebrations are organized around the U.S., honoring the accomplishments of women in society. And here at St. Mary's, we dedicate this month to highlight the contributions of women in our great city. Before I introduce our moderator, who will then introduce our distinguished guests, I would like to recognize and thank our president, Tom Mingler, for joining us this evening. We also have our dean, Dr. Henry Flores, our provost, Andre Hampton, my colleague and also a faculty member is Mr. Alex Briseño.
That's so good to see you.
Got lost on it.
And the chair of our graduate program, Dr. Art Vega. Somewhere around. This evening, we wanted to host a conversation with our distinguished guests about their journey as women serving on City Council. Tonight, we will hear voices from the past converge with the voices of the present to reflect, share, and hopefully inspire women to serve as future leaders of our city. Therefore, we found it most fitting to invite Sonia Rodriguez to serve as moderator of this evening's community conversation. Sonia Rodriguez is an attorney and equity partner in the law firm of Branton Hall Rodriguez Cruz here in San Antonio. Sonia was born and raised in San Antonio. She graduated from Burbank High School. She received her BA in political science from the University of North Texas and her JD from St. Mary's University School of Law. Sonia was a co-founder of The Scholar, St. Mary's Law Review on Minority Issues. The Law Journal is currently in its 14th year of publication. She currently serves as the chairwoman of the Mayor's Commission on the Status of Women in San Antonio. Having been appointed to the commission by Mayor Phil Hardberger in 2005 and reappointed to the commission by Mayor Julian Castro in 2009. In addition to her many professional and community efforts, Sonia also serves on the executive board of SA 2020. The entity was created after Mayor Castro's citywide dialogue highlighted visions in the city for the city in 2020. She has been inducted into the San Antonio Women's Hall of Fame, received the Distinguished Young Alumna Award from St. Mary's Law Alumni Association, and in 2011, the Mexican American Bar Association of San Antonio recognized Sonia as its Lawyer of the Year for her dedication to the legal profession and to the residents of San Antonio. Please join me in welcoming Ms. Sonia Rodriguez.
Thank you for inviting me to join you tonight. It is such a treat for me to sit here and moderate a discussion with such strong and passionate and intelligent women who are leaders in our community and who have been heroes to me personally. And so with that, let me introduce our panelists. Maria Berriozabal, Maria Antonieta Berriozabal, has been contributing to the community of San Antonio for over 50 years. In 1981, she was elected to the San Antonio City Council, becoming the first Latina to be elected to such a position in San Antonio. She served with distinction as a strong, outspoken, and independent elected official. In 1991, she ran for mayor of San Antonio and was very narrowly defeated. Her impressive race was the first in a major city of the United States. She has been a founder and co-founder of Latina women's organizations locally and nationally and is a pioneer in organizing people at the grassroots level. Her work on numerous boards and commissions has taken her throughout the U.S. and abroad and has touched little girls from the West Side like me. Ms. Berriozabal has always felt that the knowledge she has gained from her public service must be shared with the community, especially her younger generations. She is a mentor of young people, inspiring and supporting them in their own journeys. She is a supporter of individuals and grassroots organizations that are promoting principles of human rights, social and economic justice, sustainable development, and values of cultural diversity and gender equality. Her memoir, Maria, Daughter of Immigrants, where she chronicles her personal and political trajectory, was published in the fall of 2012. Please join me in welcoming Maria Berriozabal. We're also honored by the presence of Helen Dutmer. She served on the San Antonio City Council from May 1977 to August 1991, and then 6 years on the Bexar County Commissioner's Court. She was the first woman to ever serve on the five-member court in its 200-year history. Talk about groundbreaking. Mrs. Dutmer has dealt with many significant environmental issues facing Central Texas. She's been active with appointed bodies such as the San Antonio Zoning Commission and with nonprofit environmental groups, including the Aquifer Protection Association and the Bexar Safe Water Committee. Many of the issues she's worked on revolved around infrastructure investments and regulatory decisions for protection of groundwater and surface water in the region. For example, she was involved in opposition during the early 1990s to the construction of Applewhite Reservoir on the Medina River, construction of the Dos Rios wastewater treatment plant during the 1980s, and passage of Ordinance 18106, an early and seminal effort in 1977 to control development over the Edwards Aquifer Recharge Zone. Thank you for your efforts to save our water. Mrs. Dutmer has worked with her husband, Jack, in their company, Jack Dutmer Industrial Laboratories, for 42 years. She was inducted into the San Antonio Women's Hall of Fame in 1985 and Woman of the Year by the South Bexar Chamber of Commerce in 1975. She was also Texas Businesswoman of the Year in 1982. Thank you for joining us, Mrs. Dutmer. Thank you also to our panelist, Councilwoman Ivy Taylor. Ivy Taylor was elected to serve as District 2 councilperson on June 13, 2009. Ms. Taylor is wife, mom, and city planner. She began her career working for the City of San Antonio in the Housing and Community Development Department and the Neighborhood Action Department. While at the city, she worked with a variety of neighborhood associations, developers, and nonprofit organizations in order to facilitate inner-city redevelopment. She's also planned several of the city housing summits, which provided an opportunity for community partners to exchange practical ideas on how to address our city housing needs. After 6 years with the city, she left employment to implement programs focused on children, education, health, and financial literacy for apartment community residents. She is a lecturer at UTSA in the Department of Public Administration. Councilwoman Taylor obtained her degree in city and regional planning for the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in 1988. In 1992, she received a bachelor's degree from Yale University. Thank you, Councilwoman Taylor, for joining us tonight. Councilwoman Leticia Osuna is proud to represent the community of the Southeast San Antonio and is working to improve the quality of life, economic vitality, and educational achievement, cultural activity, and technological development of District 3 for its residents. District 3 is home to the San Antonio Missions National Historical Park, Texas A&M University San Antonio, Toyota, Brooks City Base, City Base Landing, City Base West, Mission Trails, that's a big district. You're a busy woman. Mission Trails Baptist Hospital, Mitchell Lake Audubon Center, Stinson Airport, and the Mission Reach Project along the San Antonio River, as well as several other high-quality golf courses and public parks. Since her appointment to City Council on January 12, 2012, Councilwoman Ozuna has led efforts to preserve more than half of the area of the Pecan Valley Golf Course as green space. She's also pushed for the creation of San Antonio Area Broadband Network to expand high-speed internet access to public organizations in cooperation with CPS Energy. Thank you, Councilwoman Ozuna, for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We've obviously got a stellar panel of women leaders in our community to host this community conversation. And with respect to historical context of our panelists, I think it's interesting to note just generally, let me read through some highlights in our city's history to get your brains working and juices flowing with respect to the kinds of questions that we'd like to pose to the panelists. And if the audience feels like we need to jumpstart it with some of my questions, I certainly will. But for context, let's think in 1975, Lila Cockrell was the first woman elected as mayor of San Antonio. She was initially elected to the city council in 1966. In 1977, single-member districts were enacted, which created a new city representative, a new representative city council. This was the first time, 1977, when true debate among city council members took place. Some saw this as political instability. Others considered it a true representative democracy. Helen Dutmer was elected in District 3. Henry C. Sniddles was elected in District 1. That was 1977. So move ahead to 1981, and Henry C. Sniddles is elected mayor. And Maria Antonieta Berriozabal was elected as the first Latina councilwoman in District 1 that year. 1991, jump ahead, there were strict term limits enacted, two-year terms, that gave more power to city staff, and council representation was a revolving door in short terms. Helen Dutmer resigned from city council that year, 1991, and Maria Antonieta Berriozabal ran for mayor against Nelson Wolf in 1991 and was narrowly defeated in a runoff race. 3 years later, 1993, Helen Dutmer was elected as county commissioner, again, the first woman to ever serve in this role as Bexar County. No other woman has been elected to commissioner's court except for
Cindy Taylor Cryer
in that position. So for our first question to Maria Antonieta Berriozabal and Helen Dutmer, what organic qualities existed at the times that you decided to run that inspired you to run in spite of the fact that historically no one had led ahead of you? You were the firsts, respectively. And so first to Maria and then to Helen, what inspired you to run despite the fact that there hadn't been anyone before you in that role?
I had been living in District 1 since I was like 10 months old and had been very active in my community, in my church, first of all, developing my leadership after Vatican II when women started getting invited to participate in liturgies and so on. It was the first time I took a microphone and spoke from the microphone. And then I started working on women's organizations. We founded the Mexican American Business and Professional Women's Club in 1972. And when Henry Cisneros decided to leave Council District 1 and run for mayor, there was a group of Latinas, Choco Mesa, Silvia Rodriguez, God rest her soul, Rosie Castro, and we decided it's time for a Latina to get elected to the city council. So we started looking around. And as I went and asked people, run for city council, you know, we need somebody, there's never been a Latina. people would say, no, I can't, it only pays $20, or I have children, or my husband won't let me, or this is just not my cup of tea. But you run, Maria. And that was the farthest thing from my mind. It just, You don't grow up in the West Side in the time I grew up thinking that you would run for public office. But more and more people started telling me, and one day there was no reason not to run. As a matter of fact, my husband who's here today, I'm very grateful, my faithful companion for 36 years, I was thinking about it, and he said, you know what, you're afraid to lose. And I said, no way am I afraid to lose.
There's nothing like a challenge to inspire you.
So that did it. In other words, I ran because there was no reason to run, and I had too many people asking me to do it.
That's great. Helen?
Me? All right. To begin with, I was a legal secretary before I got on to the council. I ran the office of John, can't even think, what's his name? He's UTSA.
John Peace.
John Peace. I told you what a 92-year-old brain is. I was his office manager and secretary. John was a wonderful person, but he dropped dead in his office of a heart attack. And I was 55 years old, too old to go looking for another job. it was the era when the young girls were wearing short skirts. And that's what they wanted. They put everything in the bottom drawer. I had gotten interested because in the council, or the city rather, because he was trying to bring UTSA to San Antonio at that time and wanted to put it where it is located today. He and five other people that owned the land there. Someone at City Hall also had land in that vicinity, and they were trying to scuttle UTSA. So he told me, Helen, go down to find out what's going on there. But he didn't use that nice language. And so that's how I went to City Hall, and I sat there week after week after week. And, oh boy, I even blew the system. But I sat there week after week after week getting used to what was going on down there, and they never could figure out what I was doing down there. And I'd take my mother along, and we'd just sit there and listen. So finally I caught on to what they were trying to do down there, and yes, I did find out who it was, and no, I'm not going to tell anybody who it was. The man is still living. And so at any rate, he was my friend as well as my brother's best friend, and that was Bob Billa. And Bob Billa was sitting on the council at that time. Well, I guess because he knew me so well, he thought he could make a smart remark to me. And I felt it was out of place where we were. And so I said, you just got yourself an opponent, brother. And he said, good, welcome to the fight. I beat him 3 times. But anyhow, Bob was a wonderful person, actually. And he died of cancer of the spine. And he was dying at the time that when I left the council to go over to Commissioner's Court. And in my vacancy, in my resignation, I asked that Linda Billa Burke take my place, and she did. And I will never, so long as God gives me life, forget the expression on her dad's face. He actually cried. And so I feel very, very good about that part. But that's how I got into politics.
I think that begs the question, you know, the discussions that you've both raised lead us to wonder whether or not there's some impetus, a challenge, somebody suggesting you're just afraid to lose, or an inspiration telling you, suggesting maybe you can't do it, to spur you to run. And so for Councilwoman Taylor and our current councilwomen on the panel, I think it'd be interesting to discuss what inspired you to run as women.
Okay, well, my story is not nearly so colorful, but as you mentioned in my biography, Sonia, I'm a city planner. I have a master's degree in city planning, and my area of interest was affordable housing. I'm not a native San Antonian. I moved here in 1998. My husband is a native San Antonian. When I moved here, which was right after graduate school, I thought that I would get like a dream job at a nonprofit that was making great strides in changing neighborhoods. Well, that job didn't materialize when I moved here, so I said, well, maybe I could go work for the city, because I'd met a few folks from that worked for the city of San Antonio when I came here for a summer internship, which is how I ended up meeting my husband. So I applied for a job. Alex Briceño was the city manager at the time, and Francis Gonzalez hired me in the Neighborhood Action Department. So I worked for Francis for a year. I worked for Drew Cameron for 5 years as a grants coordinator for an affordable housing program. However, I will say that I didn't think that the city was progressive enough, excuse me, Alex, though the council or the policy makers. So I didn't feel that there was enough emphasis on inner city revitalization or affordable housing. So I left because a job did materialize at a nonprofit organization, Merced Housing Texas. So I started working there, worked there for 5 years. During my 5 years there, I began to realize that housing was not the magic bullet as far as creating stable, safe neighborhoods for families that are struggling, because we were providing wonderful housing and many of our families were still struggling. So I was really wrestling with, you know, well, what else could I do to help improve neighborhoods? I thought about being a teacher, but that wasn't quite the best fit. And I was thinking about going to graduate school to maybe get a PhD in public policy. And I wasn't thinking at all about running for public office. My best friend came to visit me from New York. That's where I was from, born in Brooklyn, raised in Queens. So I'm a recovering New Yorker. And my best friend came to visit me, and I was showing her around town. And she said to me, she's known me since I was 15, I guess. So she just said to me, do you think you would ever run for office? And I said, you have got to be kidding. I am not the one, because I'm not always politically correct. I might say something that would get myself in trouble. And so I put that to rest. And then about a week later, a couple of folks that I know from the community, from the District 2 community, called me up and said, we want you to run for the District 2 council seat. And I said, you've got to be kidding. So then I really thought about, well, the experience that I had as a former city employee, as a trained urban planner, as someone who's passionate about inner city revitalization. And I said, well, maybe I do have something to bring to the table, and I decided to run. And so that's how I got into it. I did have a pretty interesting race because I was running against a native son who had run twice before and ended up in a quite tough runoff, but prevailed by 54 votes, so every vote counts. Everyone remember to vote on May 11th.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Leticia?
Yes. All right. Hold on.
Here, let me have that microphone.
Is that better? Okay. I'm a native San Antonian. I grew up here. My dad's from here. My grandparents are from here. My great-grandparents are from here. My mother's from far south Texas, and this is her Manhattan. It doesn't get better than San Antonio. And you were in office as I was growing up, Maria. And Helen, your name came up on the news all the time, you know, breaking into my afternoon cartoons to stay tuned for the 5 o'clock news, because you were going to have something to say. And I know that planted a seed. I know that. That planted a seed. I went away. I was very fortunate. As I was growing up, the parks were well-funded. There were after-school programs. There were swimming pools that were open on the weekends and in the summertime. There was safe neighborhoods that we could leave the house and go to the pool. There we had, I can't believe this, but the parks actually had like a theater production thing that we could do after school on the weekends. The libraries were open. So that was the city inside of the loop that I grew up in. And I was lucky. I was very fortunate. I did work hard, and I had a scholarship to the University of Texas at Austin after I graduated. And I went off and did that and was very, really wanted to see how far I could go and what I could do. I had a baby. We moved to Haiti. I looked around, saw all these people in graduate school, decided that they weren't geniuses. I could do that, too. I got a National Science Foundation fellowship to go to Texas A&M. I did that. It's really hard to have a baby and be in graduate school. I don't know if any of you guys are suffering from it, but I know, I could relate. I got my training there. I couldn't stay through. It was too much of a challenge. That hill was too high for me to climb at that time. So I left with a really just amazing skill set and went to work. I went to Austin, and I went to work for engineering consulting companies. I went to work for the state of Texas and fell in with an amazing group of people that convinced me that it was a really good idea to pull all the equity of my house and move to Washington, D.C. to do this software startup company that we were going to partner with a Belgian company and sell enterprise-level software solutions to the intelligence community of the United States. Oh, that sounds great. Sign me up. So we did. We did. We started off in a bakery near King Street in Old Town Alexandria because that was a cool zip code to have. We didn't even have parking. You'd have to swap in and out trying to grow our sales cycle. We worked really, really hard. By that time, I had two kids. I didn't see them very much. I know that. I think a lot about what it takes to be ambitious, to go after something that you see as attainable. My background is not very forgiving for making a lot of the choices that I made between 1997 and 2010, even, 2013. So that has been, I think, the biggest challenge was all of the time that it went to growing the company and making sure I wanted a good outcome for my kids. I mean, I want to think of myself as a good mom. So there was a lot of that. At the end of it, we did what the big dream was, which was to sell our company. So we got it. We positioned it. We sold it to a multinational in 2008. I bought my house in San Antonio in 2009. I bought a one-way ticket, and I was, out of there. I was going to come home. I wanted my daughter to know what it was to grow up with her cousins, to know what it was like for me growing up here. And also, I wanted more. When I was in D.C. doing presentations to the CIA or to SAIC or to Northrop Grumman or whoever it was that we were meeting with doing the presentation, we would finish the presentation, we would be done with it, and we would be wrapping up and leaving, and the people would turn to me and say, "So where in Pakistan did your family emigrate from? It's getting late and it's Friday night. Don't you have to leave now?" Because they thought, I was I'm Jewish, and where in India are you from? I mean, you'd get all of these questions, and it finally dawned on me. I mean, they weren't being disrespectful, but they had never seen Latinas at the table negotiating with them, working at that level, okay? And it really made me angry. It made me really enraged, really, because it doesn't seem, and I don't believe it's insurmountable. I think a lot of it is just imagination. And then the second thing that made me stop and think was watching, our company was started right at the eve of 9/11. And we moved to the DC area, and you could see the infusion of federal dollars into the Virginia, Maryland area, how much money they were spending on buildings and staffing and people. And I know my city. My city is Military City, USA, my hometown. And I could not, for the life of me, not understand every time we would come home for Christmas or Thanksgiving that I didn't see that corollary spending happening here, that we didn't have representation in D.C. bringing that money to San Antonio, where it made a lot of sense, frankly, to do that. So those two things really made me just stop and think that when I go home, I want to do something to change this. And I didn't know what it was. I hadn't formulated. It was really kind of like, I just want to do something about it. So I came back and I started getting involved with as many things as I could, trying to meet as many people. And my city councilwoman stepped down with over 400 days left to serve, and I freaked out. We hadn't passed the budget. We hadn't passed the bond. I had worked on the bond committee. I mean, there were so many things that were so critical to the next 5 years that I kind of thought, well, why not me? Why not me? You know, and if I don't get it, well, I've learned something, and it's not like, you know, I've gotten everything I've ever wanted before. I might as well just try. But I also had to take a triple dare to do it, because it's not an easy choice. I mean, you know, I had promised my daughter that we were going to have time for all of these things, and all of a sudden, a lot of stuff just kind of went, well, that's just not going to happen exactly like we thought it was. It's going to take a different form. It did happen. I did get appointed. I enjoy this job very much, but I think that this is a good segue to talk about, you know, that there are constant balances. I still work. I'm a mom, and this is really a really, really important city council service is very, very important, and many times it is the first thing on my list. Sometimes it's 1 through 10 on my list. A lot of times it's 1 through 10 on my list, and that's just part of the...
There are so many commonalities in what inspired you to run. I have at least, and I want to apologize, I'm not checking my emails right now. I'm looking up some statistics, and I'm thinking of questions. So if the audience doesn't have them, I'm taking over all this time. So why don't we take a question from the audience at this point so that I don't monopolize the ladies' time. We have a question? Okay, then I get to ask my question then. My question is, the Brookings Institute says that one of the reasons that women are underrepresented in politics is that they are simply less likely to be recruited to run. I think that's something that each of you have talked about. Why do you think it is, and maybe things are changing, and hopefully each of you will talk a little bit about why hopefully maybe things are changing in Bexar County. One of the things that just tugs at my heart, Helen, is that over 200 years in Bexar County, we still only have two women who've ever served on Commissioner's Court. So the question comes back to, why do you think that women are not recruited to run as much as men are recruited to run in politics? We'll start first. Why don't we start with Maria and just kind of go across? Or if you're going to go, we need to give you your microphone. Why don't you go first, and then we'll...
Well, I suppose that I have an advantage here over some of these younger women. The role of women from the time that I was growing up and getting into the world, the business world, going to school and whatnot, the role of women has changed drastically. In my day, women didn't go to college. Women went to college, those that went to college, went to see if they could find a guy that had enough money to satisfy their wants. They did not go with the idea that they had a career in front of them. So I can't put the word to it, but it was just a time when women did not go to universities or colleges or go further in their education than high school. But our high school educations were equal to, now if I'm to believe my great-granddaughter, she is a professor at Stephen F. Austin College University over in Nacogdoches, Texas. And if I am to believe her, It's most of the youngsters are sending now, they have to teach before they can, they have to teach them their routine and their entries before they can even enter into learning what university and college educations are all about. She said it is sad. They are sending them to them uneducated, actually, in the necessary things for a college or university education. So that is one thing that changed women. The other thing is women are mamas. They're mama. They have children they want to take care of at home while daddy goes out and earns a living. That was our day. The women did not go into the community and work if they had children. They stayed at home and took care of their kids. Let me see, some of the other things that have taken place are after the war. Now, during World War II, not one, two. During World War II, although I was born right at the end of it, World War I. In World War II, women went to work. The men were overseas fighting, so the women went to work. And they got their first taste of being out into the community and doing what would make the future change. And so now it is just commonplace for both man and woman to work, for women to have families, to tend to the house, and still go out and work because it's enjoyable. Number one, you have to love people. Is that not true? You have to be among the people in the community to know. Now, I've been retired for 10 years, and I still work at every board. Everything that they ask me to do, I still have people call me to do things, and I refer them to our new councilwoman, who's doing a very good job, by the way. And so that's why women have changed. Now, you don't go and recruit women for this very simple reason. You don't have to. Those that will be free and have someone to support the family can go out into the community. Those people will seek office irrespective. Now, if you find someone who you think will do a very good job, like we have, and put them on the council, then it's up to them to prove that women can serve the universe, if necessary. So that's the only story I have. I don't think you need to recruit women. You just chat with them like we're chatting here right now, and they say, hey, she'd make a pretty good candidate. And so that's it. The only other philosophy that I have is if I don't have fun, I don't do it.
Maria, what do you think? The question was why the Brookings Institute says that one of the reasons why women are underrepresented in politics is that women are less likely to be recruited to run than men. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the the question you ask has been written about, research, and there are many, many studies about leadership, about men's leadership and women's leadership. And one of the facts is that men are individualistic in their leadership. You know, a man goes into his job or gets elected, and right away it's about forming that network with the other men who are in there, whether it's city council, whether it's commissioner's court, the legislature, the Congress, or the Senate of the United States. So the guys go into that bubble very comfortably. Women's leadership is very different. Women's leadership is communal. Women, number one, the ones that finally make it is because they had been teachers, they had been like Helen working in the neighborhood, They're connected to the community. It's two very different kinds of leadership. The woman isn't in there trying to get into that bubble so she can have all these guys or gals helping her to move ahead. She's there building community, working with the people that she's supposed to be working with. And those two different ways of being has a lot to do with what women end up doing. Carol Gilligan, this eminent scholar, I think she still teaches at Harvard, did a study of little girls' leadership of women. She started with little girls. And what she noticed is that when the little girls were playing, when the boys were playing, they would start a game. And they would set rules. Said, these are the rules, you know. And the little boys followed the rules because they wanted to be part of this team. And they kept the game going for a long time. The little girls of the same age in the same playground started playing a game. But when one of the little members of the group had a problem with a rule, they changed it. And because it was more important to kind of have the collegiality, to have the friendship, to have not hurt feelings. So the team way of doing it got the guys further than the collaborative way of doing it. And I think it's really important that young women understand this and that we form networks based on that asset. And like with me, you have no idea how many young women,
you know, doing the leaning, but the way that I interpret the story is that usually it's just a lot of crap coming at you really fast, like this, that forces you to do that. But I think that when you talk about the 10 or 15 times, it's because that's the way for a woman leader, that is just going to be her natural stance, is to be leaning in and deciding, do I want to take on one more thing, you know, to have all of this stuff that I see as, you know, my goal. And that's just kind of my way
of... Something about that book, which I have found very interesting because it's quantifiable data, that women, when they're applying for a job, they have to be 100% sure that they're qualified. Men just have to be, 80%?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, so men don't have to feel that they're perfectly qualified, but a woman, we're harder on ourselves.
Our expectations are much higher.
Our expectations of ourselves. And you know, like the fact, I mean, just to be brutally honest, there's two women on the city council. There's no women on commissioner's court. There's no women in our Bexar County legislative delegation. We've never had a congresswoman. I did run for it. We've never had a senator. So it's like there's something wrong. I mean, and I know women that I have helped in this city to run. And this bubble of men who already have a network put everything they have against them. You know, and they're out there, they ran. It's not that women don't run. And they ran on their own, they weren't invited, and they lost.
So do you see that is going to change if the voters make it change, or does that network, that bubble of men who won't let them come up, has to change before the voters can make it change?
I think we have to start challenging the bubble of men and say it, and not just be so happy that they're there and not challenge them.
Somebody have a question?
I think it would in women that you have mentioned. But
can you repeat the question? So I'm not sure everybody heard.
She said that there's a lot of women that are heads of their own household, and there are limitations. So probably that's the reason they don't run. Well, I think that a woman like the one you described, of course. But my experience is that there are plenty that are very well qualified. You know, so maybe when you take a percentage, you'll see that in San Antonio, we're still a poor city. So you're going to see that a lot of women are still in that category. But I also know that there's a hefty number of very well-prepared women, because I know them.
We had another question over on this side.
Hi, my name is Tanari. Thank you. Hi, my name is Tanari. I'm a senior political science major. And it's very interesting for me to be here because I conduct the research as a McNair Scholar on Latina state legislators in Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, and California last summer as well. And one of the things that when I interviewed former Representative Veronica Gonzalez on her leadership and why she decided to run for office, her biggest obstacle was, or factor in deciding to run for office was fundraising, getting the money in campaigns because it's harder for women to gain that money and funds for her campaigns. And she said, I was a private lawyer at a private law firm, and she was actually invited by her coworkers or recruited in a way, say, hey, you should run for office and challenge the opponent that had been there for a while already. And she said it was a tough decision because she was going to leave a private job to go into a public office that wasn't going to be paid the same. And I also, throughout the studies and interviewing other politicians, especially from Arizona, yeah, definitely correct. It's always they begin in grassroots area and they move up. And the other interesting thing that Maria Varisalva, you mentioned is that we see an increase of female politicians at a city level, but as we start moving higher, it decreases, and decreases even more. So it's been one of my passion, and I hope to one day serve in a public office. But how do we exactly take the necessary steps to break that cycle or break those boundaries for me to move beyond the city council, to be a congresswoman, and maybe one day be the president? How do we combat all those obstacles as women if it's a big issue. So I don't know. I just want to thank you guys also. I mean, it's very refreshing and motivating to be here and listen to powerful women because it's encouraging for me to listen and to see that there are great women out there doing great work.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. Why don't we talk, maybe we can start with Leticia and kind of go through this way. What words do you have for women who are of this younger generation who are looking to you as breaking that glass ceiling, looking to you to break the glass ceiling when the reality is, as Maria pointed out, that we can do and we can run, but if you look at the statistics, we still have these very real raw statistics. And so if we can kind of go across what your advice is, if you could go back and either do it differently or change the dynamic or give these young women some ideas to change the dynamic.
Yeah, I think that in this city particularly, it is a challenge. Because make no mistake, a life of a city council person or a state representative or a congressman, that's a career choice. And the difficulty with San Antonio is that, unlike many of the major cities, it is considered a voluntary posting. There are other political appointments, processes that don't take. The other part about the reality of city council is that it is very intense. It is not cyclical. There is never an off window. It is always on. And I think that just structurally, that immediately poses challenges to anyone considering to run. And I think that there is something that, that the electorate or the people who are represented should have that conversation about what does it mean to have a volunteer city council? What are your expectations of your city council? What value do you place on the role that they play, the power that you give them, versus how, you as a tax base, how you compensate that position? And that's something that I think is a conversation that our city should have. Other cities have had it. Because that, it's especially in the district that I serve, which is a median income in some zip codes of about $30,000 per person. So you can imagine just right off the bat, there are huge economic hurdles for the vast majority of citizens. And the other thing I want to say is that the fundraising challenge is just another big part of it, especially as you move into the congressional arena. And I like to tell my son, I'm just so happy you have fungible skills. I think that anyone that wants to consider this track needs to have a serious inward look at what fungible skills do I have, do I possess, to be able to, you know, live through the gaps, right, of the position. And I think that that's a realistic conversation, especially here in San Antonio, given the political landscape that we have. And the first thing should be to acquire the fungible skills, and then the second is, you know, to do all of the groundwork that you need to do to position yourself. I mean, I can't think of another way that somebody could adequately represent an area like Districts 3 or 4 or 2 or 5 even. That's just the reality that I observe.
I think that's a really good point. Obviously, you know, making public service such that we can serve without having to sacrifice our livelihoods. Councilwoman Taylor, what other suggestions do you have for younger women who are looking to run for office and what they can do to break that ceiling?
I'm going to start from a little more basic stance for folks who may have had experiences like I've had. As a minority whose parents didn't go to college, my parents did encourage me to go to college, but it was like college, you know, after college somehow, you know, a wonderful job is going to materialize. But all throughout my growing up years, no one ever talked to me about what are the things that you're interested in? What is your passion? What do you want to do? What do you want to be? And so really I left Yale, which was a pretty good school, with no clue still. Like, I got home from Yale and got the Sunday Times looking for a job. Now, 20 years later, I'm like, that is so pitiful. But I didn't know anything else to do. So I really would like to offer that advice to the young folks to take the time to think about what it is that you're interested in. What is your passion? Because then that will drive what you do. And definitely for a career in public service, it can't be about being in the position. It's got to be about your passion and your interests. The one thing that was taught to me at a young age, but I didn't understand at the time, was this concept of networking. I have a good friend who's visiting me from Richmond, Virginia, Bernadine. She's sitting next to my daughter. We met when I was 19 and she was 18, and we met through a program called En-ROADS. And En-ROADS doesn't have a chapter here in San Antonio. I wish it did. En-ROADS is a career development program for minority college students. Now, this was late 80s, so at that time, the holy grail for you if you were coming out of college and you're a minority was a corporate job. Now, neither Bernadine and I, we were both in that program, but now she's a reverend and I'm an elected official. So. But the one thing that, it provided us training on the corporate world, and for folks whose parents weren't in that, that was valuable. But they talked all the time about networking, but I don't think I really understood what that meant until I was about 26. So I encourage young people to think about how you can expand your network. Meeting people who have similar interests, or even meeting people who are doing something totally opposite of what your passions are, and just forming friendships with them and alliances, and you never know when you'll have the opportunity to call on that person, to work with that person. And actually, I also found that that's actually how you get jobs, not through looking at the Sunday New York Times, it's through your network. So those are the two key things that I will offer to young people, is to pursue your passion and to build and expand your network.
That's good advice. Helen, I think one of the jarring things that we're learning when we see the statistics about how few women are actually in those positions of political leadership is how little it's changed. So what advice do you have for young women who want to be the next county commissioner, only the third woman in the history of the 200-year history of the county commissioner's court? What advice do you have about breaking that glass ceiling?
Well, I don't know that my advice would be taken anyhow. I've got a daughter that hasn't taken it. But at any rate, if you have a love of your fellow man, and I say man as mankind, which includes women. And it's a good thing that the Lord was a man, because if it'd been a woman, you guys would be in our position today. So thank the Lord he was a man. At any rate, for the younger generation, it's a little hard for me, for the simple reason that I have been through just about everything. And the thing that guided me was a desire to see my fellow person. I was raised, believe it or not, there were two girls and 20 boys in our neighborhood. I didn't play dolls. I played baseball, cops and robbers, climbed trees, dug caves, did all the things that the male did. So I look at them in a different way than what you look today. Now, I know that's hard for you to understand because you haven't been there, but I've been there. And I think a lot of it is in the way you view the younger generation today, and in that, the younger women. Now, to me, younger women, if they're 70 years old, they're young. But at any rate, those who are in the classification of age to run for a public office, they would have to have a desire to change something, to progress something. If I just had the time, and I would tell you when I was raised coming up, there were three sections of the city of San Antonio. No north side, no north side, no west side. Yeah, there was a small west side in the inner city. But there was the east side. It went only as far as New Braunfels Avenue. That was the end of it. The rest was brush. There were no people of color except for one family. And he was a part of our baseball team. But at any rate, there was the east side, went as far as New Braunfels Avenue, and you hear Fort Sam Houston and 900 block of North New Braunfels Avenue was the end of the city of San Antonio. The west side was, I believe it was Friel Street at that time. My dad was raised over there. All right, so there was a downtown, which consisted of Houston Street, Commerce Street, St. Mary's Street, Cross Street, and South Flores Street, which ran north and west. That was the city of San Antonio, period. We had none of what you see today. And so I know what we have progressed from. What do you want to progress to? Today, I think what we need are young women who are knowledgeable in economics, for one thing. We just got through building a $1 million bike trail. Of course, our streets are full of holes, and we don't have enough policemen, we don't have enough firemen. That's like going and buying a wedding dress when you haven't even met the guy you're going to marry. We need someone who understands economics, be it man or woman. That's what the city needs. And you guys, I'm not just talking about getting women into public office. You're doing a good job, most of you. But at any rate, if you find a young person who has a passion to change something that you also think needs to be changed, talk to them, help them. But if they haven't been busy in the community already, it's a lost cause.
Maria, I think that the question was actually initiated by your recognition of how far we still have yet to come. What is your advice for young women.
I echo what the women have said about networking, about having a passion, about being prepared. I mean, those are facts. I have people like, you know, my father used to have a saying in Spanish, "El diablo sabe más por viejo que por diablo." The devil knows more because he's old and because he's the devil. So once you've been around, you know, a couple of times, you learn a lot. So with me, you know, my gray hairs, and thank you, Helen. I'm 71 years old, so you've just called me young. Thank you.
My kid is 75.
And the gray hairs mean something. So I have people come to my office regularly when there's going to be an election. I want to come talk to you because I'm running for the state legislature or city council or whatever. And I am always surprised that the first question I ask is, why are you running? And they haven't thought of it. And then the advice I give, and I get to give the advice a lot. Who pays attention to it? I don't know, but I give the advice that you have to have a network of people. When I ran the first time, and I don't think it's really that different today, I won not because I had money. They say that if you have a long name, you tend not to win because you can't put it on your sign. So the shorter your name, the better chances you have. And I had just changed my name to Berriozabal. Can you imagine? So I didn't have money. I didn't know people with money. I did not get the endorsement of the Democratic Party because they were the ones that went around and, you know, got people to run. I ran against the person that they, you know, asked to run. And I had the Mexican-American established leadership against me. So it was like all that. But I still won and hung in there for 10 years without opposition except one time. And the way I did it is, number one, I had a lot of people who helped me. You know, I really believe in bodies. My political science professor, Richard Gambetta, used to say, you need three things to win. You need a good candidate, you need money, and you need a good organization. And you can win without being a good candidate. You can win without money, but you cannot win without a good organization. So people who are going to run need to have a track record where they're going to run. They have to have a list, and now it's computerized. With me, I went to my Christmas card list, my neighborhood association list, every club I had ever belonged to, the church list, and I came up with a name of 500 people who kind of, I told them they were running, would help me. So I started a campaign with 500 names of relatives, friends, and they're the ones that started raising the money and helping me. And not just that first campaign, but throughout those 10 years. So I think that's very important, you know, the networking, the having a base, because after all, democracy is about representing people. Democracy is not just about one person that gets an idea one day, I want to do this. It's that there's a body of people, and out of that body of people, somebody rises, not because they're any better, but they're the one that raise and say, I'm going to represent you. And then to get all the ones that are to be represented to help that man or woman run. And that's a very idealistic way to look at politics, but I don't want to lose it. You know, the older I get, the more I appreciate that. It's a democracy, and it's a democracy of the people, and they're the ones that should be helping. And we need to put responsibility on them, that when somebody says, hey, Maria, run for this, and I still, in fact, out here I was asked, are you going to run again? It's like, okay, I'm going to run, but you're going to help me. What? How much money are you going to give me? Not just aviéntame and then déjame sola, but it's about a little push, but I'll be with you, and to demand that we get that from the people. And I don't want to put, you know, the total blame on women, Sonia. There are reasons, big reasons, that are the big umbrella of who wins and who loses. And they're powerful, powerful economic powers in our city that dictate who can get in or not. And it has to do with what issues. Even if you're the most idealistic, the most well-prepared, the best bankrolled candidate, if you are for certain issues in this city, they're not going to let you in. So we also have to be knowledgeable what those issues are. Water, energy, growth, what is economic development? You know, I'd like to have somebody run and say economic development is taking care of people, not just having buildings, you know, or trails. So the message is also important.
Well, we've talked a little bit about the three things that, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
University. I had a Welcome. Question for you're all women, but I want to kind of change it up a bit. I wanted to see how, as women of color, how you have felt you've either had support or not had support from your Latino brothers and African American brothers.
Well, I'll jump in. I'll say it was two black men who called me up and asked me to run for office. So I haven't had that issue as far as support from the black community. Now, as the only African-American member of the city council, I will kind of put my neck out there a little bit and speak and say that I think we need to have more unity between black and brown here in San Antonio. My district is majority Latino, as is most of San Antonio. And so I take things from that perspective that I try to represent everyone's interests. I really just try to focus on neighborhood concerns, which we all want safe streets. We all want parks. We all want, you know, our kids to grow up in a good environment. I think we can all agree on that. So I think that will be a challenge for us in District 2 as the numbers continue to change. However, as a top 10 American city, personally, I feel it's very important that we continue to have an African American on our city council.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's one of the beautiful parts about San Antonio is that it's one of the few American cities that's minority-majority. And I think that lends definitely an element of working with the different chambers and working with the neighborhood associations and working on city council. I mean, the priorities in the city for a lot already have, you know, that sensibility of who we are in the city. But that being said, I do think that we have a number of challenges in terms of not so much whether we're Latino or whether we're black, but it's the economic differentials in our community really are some of the major hurdles that we have at having equal access, equal playing fields, equal distribution. That I think is more of it. It isn't so much whether I'm welcomed by the Mission Democrats or anything like that. It's more that I think that there are real economic disparities in our community that are really difficult long term. Structural problems, and they continue to challenge us, and that's one of the joys of serving on city council is to be able to have some perspective to figure out how to not just do the short-term Band-Aid, but to really think in terms of long-term structural change. I would say that is more, one of the concern of whether or not there's cultural similarity as to, you know, the economic differentials.
Maria?
I was trying to remember the question. it's been a joy, by the way. Thank you so much, St. Mary's, for having us. It's been a joy to sit with the two young councilwomen. I'm very honored to... to be with them, and also to be with Councilwoman Dudmer. We've never had a chance to do this ever, Helen.
No, we didn't.
You know, and Helen and I served on City Council for 10 years, and we came from very different districts, very different backgrounds, different political ideologies in many things, some things, but we always respected each other, and I'm just really grateful for her support when I was on City Council. Just one woman supporting another one. But I think you were talking about, like, within the Latino community, speaking for myself, and the support that I got from the Latinos. Well, we have to go back to when I got in there, and I'll say that I can't speak to how, let's say, Leticia feels as a Latina right now. But with me, I was the first one. I was the first Latina to sit with a group of men who had been together already for several years, and they had learned how to work together, and they knew each other, they were friends, and then this woman comes in. And I don't think this is different than the woman scholar who goes into the university, because I deal with a lot of women scholars, and I hear them talk about the university setting, and this Latina goes in, and the ones who are in there, all the men, and the challenges they have. We have not learned how to do that well yet. And with me, what happened is that I don't think they knew how to deal with me. And maybe it was my fault too. Maybe I didn't know how to deal with them. I wrote a book, and anybody who wants to know, how I got into City Council without any money, blah, 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 read my book, because I tell a lot of things in that book that you'll never read in any history of the city. So a lot of things will remain in my heart, because until all these people die, I don't think I'm free to talk about it. I don't want him to die, but you know what I'm saying. And I didn't get a lot of support. Okay, I pretty much bonded with my community. I bonded with my constituents, right, Alex Briseño? And I did my neighborhood work, and I did a lot of work on my own. But I wouldn't change anything. I'll just leave it at that.
We have one last question. I do have to start wrapping up, I think. I'm getting pulled off. We'll take one last question, and then we'll wrap up.
Thank you very much. Hi, my name is Vanessa Rodriguez. Thank you so much. Very inspiring. Women, first African American, first Latina, and for you. I appreciate, can you hear me? Okay, appreciate all of y'all here. I have a question speaking about networks, and I love the fact that you said male networks versus female networks and individualistic versus communal. And what I've noticed, especially with the fundraising, and women, of course, we still have the glass ceiling, not only in the workplace for our salary, but now looking in the campaign field. So I was wondering, what advice do you have for, I've noticed in some political campaigns that the males, when they're running for campaigns, they'll bring in some very strong leaders in the women networks, where when there's women issues, the women networks come together, and they cannot be broken, as you can see with healthcare and such. But for some reason, when they invite certain women leaders in the networks, then it divides the networks of women for some reason when they're supporting other women that are running for different political campaigns. So I'm just wondering, what advice do you have to unify these women networks when they have been invited from other male networks? But yet, I've seen that for some reason the males, and maybe Latinos, don't support them as much when those women are ready to run as well.
If we could just kind of go through, does anybody have an answer for that, or anybody wanting to answer that? Is that an experience?
Well, one thing I would say is that I think it's important that you have diverse networks. Though, of course, as women, it's very helpful to have networks of women that I personally try to pursue alliances throughout different venues. So I would say that that's one way to be able to address that, to not just focus on building your network within a community of women. I also believe that as women take on leadership roles in different aspects of society, that helps in that arena as well, as we have more women business leaders and business owners and running colleges and professors, and that will help as well, because we can't expect that people would just support you because you're a woman. Mm-hmm. They have to feel that you're the best qualified candidate, mm-hmm. or feel some sort of connection to your passion for the cause. So that's why it's important that you align yourself with many different types of people.
Good advice.
But I would say a lot of this job is communicating. And somebody told me that it's not enough to say it once. You have to be prepared to say something five times. You have to just really dig in and just, like, for example, with the networking, a lot of the networking is communicating. And so you have to be prepared to make, you know, the candidate case or the issue case, but it five times. I mean, like each at five different touch points in quick succession, to really get that embedded in. You might think that you're effective with one, but it five times. And the same with, I think you were talking about something about fundraising. I mean, you've got to it's not just the touch with the campaign. It's like being there face-to-face with people that you're looking to support you, but the same on the other side of the equation, which is trying to extract people from their capital, which is based on like, you know, it's a relationship, and it's five times, five communication cycles, and, I mean, you start there. Yeah. That's the only way that I can think of to, one, not get discouraged. Like my daughter says, I tried to ride or swim across the swimming pool and I didn't do it. I'm like, well, did you try 10,000 times? Because, you know, you can't say that you're not good at it. You can't say that you haven't succeeded. I mean, you really have to keep doing it.
I'd like to thank St. Mary's for hosting this historic panel discussion. I mean, I think to have Helen Dutmer and Maria Antonieta Berriozabal and our fresh new crop of city council women on the same panel is truly historic in San Antonio. I've learned a lot, and I could probably talk to these women for about two more days in a row. So thank you, St. Mary's, for hosting us. This was a wonderful conversation. An outstanding way to commemorate Women's History Month. And with that, I will hand it back over to Monica Cruz.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us this evening. And I also want to thank our very gracious moderator, Sonia Rodriguez, an alumna. And just very quickly, I also just want any women in our audience who have run campaigns or are currently running, if you could please stand. We honor you for your contributions and for being brave out there. Thank you, because it takes that step, right, to go move forward. So thank you very much. And so we have a special gift here for all our panelists. But thank you. Thank you for your words, for all that you do in our community, for inspiring many of us, mm-hmm. for planting those seeds, and that hopefully we will continue to see women move ahead in the field of politics and representation in our community and throughout the country. Thank you all, and have a good night.
It's been an honor to sit here.